Welcome back to the Lynn Rivers Show. 23 states have become so-called right-to-work states. Under right-to-work laws, employees in union representative jobs cannot be required to pay a monthly fee to that union. In no state must an individual join a union to get or keep a job. Right-to-work proponents say this is only fair. Workers shouldn't be forced to give money to a group to which they didn't choose or which they don't agree with. Others say it is only fair to require non-members to pay a fee toward the cost of collective bargaining that they benefit from. In other words, no one should get to be a freeloader. Later on in the show, we'll hear from union activist Samantha Montgomery, but my first guest today is Paul Kersey, who is the labor policy director for the Michigan-based Mackinac Center. Mr. Kersey became director of labor policy at the Mackinac Center for Public Policy in September of 2007, having served as the center's senior labor policy analyst since December 2006. As director, Kersey leads the center's labor policy initiative and researches labor and employment issues. He served on the staff of the U.S. House of Representatives Government Reform and Oversight Committee and spent 3 years at the National Right to Work Committee as director of state legislation. Paul Kersey, welcome to the Lynn Rivers Show.
Well, thank you for having me on.
As we begin this discussion, full disclosure, I belong to the Michigan Federation of Teachers as well as the Michigan Education Association. I was also married to a UAW for 24 years. Okay, Paul, I want to go to you for a definition. Who or what is the Mackinac Center?
Well, the Mackinac Center is an independent public policy research organization, a think tank, if you will, based up in Midland, Michigan, and we approach things from a classical liberal, free market-oriented frame of mind. We believe that understanding and working with markets is the best way for the state of Michigan to grow and to advance, and that government should provide some certain key services, police, fire, certain bits of infrastructure, public education, but generally the government should have a fairly limited role in society, and that individuals and the various organizations they put together, corporations, families, churches, what have you, really should take more of a leadership role in terms of addressing the problems that the society has.
So the center's position on right-to-work legislation is...
We believe that right to work would be a smart move for the state of Michigan to make.
Why do you think that?
Well, because the economic track record of right to work states over the long haul has been very positive. We see faster economic growth in those right to work states. We see faster employment growth over the last 10 years or so, especially from 2002 to 2008. Right-to-work states added 3% to their payrolls, and that's in spite of the recession that came there at the end. Non-right-to-work states saw their payrolls decrease by 3%. So jobs are definitely growing faster, and Lord knows the state could use improved employment. The other reason I would say is because it really gets back to individual choice and freedom of association. It is wrong, we would argue, to force an individual to pay dues to an organization that he or she does not support, and that may or may not be actually working in their best interests.
So I have to ask about that, though. So you think that a union that is bargaining for safe working conditions, for pay and benefits, would somehow be in opposition to the best interests of the worker?
I doubt that it happens intentionally very often, but you can't assume that the union is going to actually succeed, or that the union actually has an accurate understanding of where workers' best interests lie.
Well, give me an example of where that would be the case.
Well, consider a young worker, a young worker who's just starting out at a company. Now, the typical union contract has a lot of things that are settled by seniority. You have a salary schedule that typically provides larger pay for as you gain experience. Now, whether that experience actually translates into better productivity or anything else like that is a whole other question. But there's usually a step process for gaining wages. As a young worker, even if your performance is extremely good, you're going to be at the bottom end of that step ladder. Promotions, plum assignments tend to go to workers with more seniority. And if there's layoffs, God forbid layoffs happen, usually it's the last person to get hired is the first person to be moved out the door.
Let me put forward two things about this. First thing is since statistically salaries in right-to-work states are in fact lower than unionized states or union states, wouldn't it be a wash for a young worker? You say, well, if they have the union, they might get less than the people at a higher seniority. But if they're going to get less in a non-union state, doesn't that become a wash?
No, because first of all, wages tend to grow faster in right-to-work states, too. In fact, there are a number of right-to-work states where high per capita disposable incomes are higher than Michigan right now.
Right, but those tend to be in states where you have a real disparity between people at the top and people at the bottom, correct?
I wouldn't concede that. I haven't seen the numbers on that particular, but I don't believe that's the case. You're talking about states like Virginia, Florida, Texas, Iowa.
Right, where the people at the top, where lower-income workers are really lower-income workers.
I haven't seen those numbers.
Because certainly I saw, and I'm just going to be provocative here for a minute, when I did my research, I saw that the poverty rates in right-to-work states are higher, which suggests you have more workers working for less money in those states than you would have in the so-called union states.
Well, poverty rates are kind of deceptive thing. They're based on a flat rate of what income that applies to all states, well, all the lower 48 states anyway, without any regard to local conditions and in particular local cost of living. A $20,000 a year salary will go a lot further in rural Ohio than it will even in downtown Cleveland.
I'm sorry.
Well, the point is, and this is the other thing about wages in general and cost and in right to work states. Cost of living tends to be lower in right to work states. Meaning that your dollar goes further, and a number of studies have looked at cost of living in right to work states and concluded that wages and salaries are a wash, or that even that right to work states you come out ahead in terms of purchasing power.
Listeners, this is the Lynn Rivers Show, and I'm talking today with Paul Kersey, who is the labor policy director for the Michigan-based Mackinac Center, and we are talking about right to work legislation. You're listening to 89.1 WEMU. Well, let me go back, Paul, to this issue of how we determine benefits or costs relative to right to work, because you know I looked at a number of studies, and one of them, for example, that used Bureau of Labor Statistics in a way that counted jobs, including things like taking care of children at home, 16-year-olds who mowed the lawn at home, essentially anything that had an economic impact was viewed as employment. And so you get a very strange kind of way to determine this. So it's very slippery. You say that, well, cost of living is less in Arkansas than it is in Michigan. Wages in general are much lower in Arkansas than in Michigan. If you take Texas and Alaska, one a right-to-work state, the other one a union state, cost of living, you don't see a lot of differences in terms of employment. You don't see a lot of differences between these two. Certainly not the benefits that people argue for right-to-work.
Well, first of all, the example is kind of a peculiar one because Alaska is actually one of the few states that where the poverty rate is set higher by the federal government, and that is because cost of living is especially high in Alaska. And that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the unions. that's just a matter of they are so far away from the mainland and so distant from a lot of the distribution networks that just getting anything up there is often expensive. I mean, you have television shows about the people who fly cargo around Alaska,
right.
and it's just a huge physical challenge. So
one way or the other,
Alaska is just not a really good choice.
Well, use Michigan and Arkansas. Now, you know, because wages are low in Arkansas, and even if they're growing quickly, that could still very much and seems to mean that they're still lagging far behind union states.
Well, here's the other, the dirty little secret about right to work and the wages. Right to work states tended to be poor before they passed right to work.
Right.
So you have sort of a legacy that is in place that predates even the Great Depression in a lot of cases and predates certainly the Taft-Hartley law that created the opening for right to work states. So again, wages tend to be growing faster in right-to-work states, and that implies that there is, at the very least, opportunities for advancement in right-to-work states that you don't have in non-right-to-work states.
Right, but if you're talking about moving from a $9 an hour job to an $11 an hour job, that's a big jump percentage-wise, but that still puts people at a tremendous disadvantage in terms of a tremendous disadvantage relative to union states. I mean, I don't know how you can compare an average of, say, $13 an hour to an average of $20 an hour. Go ahead.
Well, I guess what I would say is this. I think that the main fear that people have is that if right to work is passed in Michigan, yeah, you'll have more jobs, but they'll be lower paying jobs. That's the fear that people have. But the experience of Oklahoma when they passed their right to work bill is that wages were increasing at basically the same rate before and after they passed the right to work law. There is no inflection point. There's not any hint of turning in terms of what wages were doing in Oklahoma before and after.
So why
if
make
wages
the change?
Were increasing beforehand, they will be increasing afterward, and you will not see any substantial pay cuts, at least certainly not anything across the board.
So why make the change?
Because you will see increased availability of employment, and Michigan right now could still really use a boost in terms of creating jobs.
Well, will right to work bring back auto jobs here?
Possibly. I can't talk specifically about specific sectors. But there are a wide range of jobs where right to work is associated with improved employment pretty much across the board. Manufacturing, service sector jobs, private sector jobs in particular, right to work is an advantage. So it certainly wouldn't hurt if what you're concerned about is the auto industry. It certainly wouldn't hurt.
Well, I looked at a study done by the Cato Institute where they argued that if right to work had been in place in Michigan, there would be 950,000 more auto jobs, which means we'd have 950,000 more auto workers out of work because the industry is in trouble. In other words, having more workers, I know there's sort of this supply side argument, but having more workers doesn't mean that we have less unemployment or we have more income. I mean, I think that the numbers can be really manipulated there.
Right to work, as I said, is associated with better rates of job creation. As, again, from 2002 to 2010, the typical right to work state added about 3% to payrolls. That's not employment or the number of employees or the number of people in the workforce. That's employment, jobs. Non-right to work states like Michigan saw employment dropped by 3% during the same period, and Michigan had a particularly rough go of it.
Right, because of the auto industry.
Yeah, yeah. And that was a huge part of it, yes. But mm-hmm. Michigan had a particularly rough go of it. I think we would be much better off joining the right to work states and getting employment to advance at them.
We're going to take a break, And when we come back, I'm going to continue this conversation with Paul Kersey, who's the Labor Policy Director for the Michigan-based Mackinac Center. We are back on the Lynn Rivers Show today. We are talking about right-to-work states, right-to-work laws, how they affect the economy in states that have them and states that don't. My guest today is Paul Kersey, who is the Labor Policy Director for the Michigan-based Mackinac Center. Now, Paul, before we went on break, you were suggesting that right-to-work would be good for Michigan. And I'm wondering how that would be. How you see, and sort of specifically, how you see new jobs being developed, new industry or new businesses coming to Michigan as a result of that?
Well, I think the main advantage is that employers understand that when they build a plant in Michigan, and they know that that unions are going to be out there, and that there are unions that will at least consider stepping in and trying to organize their workers. When you have a right-to-work law in place, you know that individual workers can give or withhold their support. And most workers actually do join in right-to-work states. In excess of 75% of workers will join voluntarily. But they know that the union can have dues withdrawn from them if they're not really representing what workers want. And that changes the incentives for unions. It means that they have to pay a lot closer attention to what the rank and file actually wants done.
Well, when you say that the union doesn't do things that benefit the worker, certainly there are a number of workers who want essentially the benefit of more money in their paycheck. So you have people who are in the very advantageous position of benefiting from the bargaining that goes on behalf of the unionized members without having to put any cost into it. In other words, they can simply keep their own money and then essentially freeload on the benefits of union bargaining that's being paid for by other people.
Well, I mean, everybody wants better wages and better working conditions and better benefits. That's pretty much beyond dispute. Like I said, most workers actually do join the union voluntarily because most workers can be trusted to make these decisions. We think that workers can be trusted to evaluate what the situation is and decide whether the union really is delivering for them. And most workers will do just that if they see that the union is working
well
for them.
There's this truism where we say when it's everyone's job, it's nobody's job. I mean, it seems to me that if you have 25% of workers not participating, not contributing, and 75% of the workers are paying for 100% of the bargaining, there just seems to be something inequitable about that, especially since 100% of the workers get the benefit of that bargaining.
Again, I would talk about the young worker coming in who is put at a disadvantage because of the specific terms of the union contract.
You can
say that every worker benefits from the union contract, and there probably are some people who do get some concrete benefits who do not pay in. But I don't think we can assume from our safe. From our safe distance here, that every worker benefits. And again, you have to let workers make these choices. They're the best. They're the people who are on the shop floor. They're the people who are affected by this. They know better than we do whether the union really is working out for them or not.
Now, unions have played a really important role historically in the development of safe workplaces, reasonable wage and hour issues, retirement benefits, etc. And it seems like now, once those protections have become sort of part of our societal outlook on jobs, we're saying, well, we don't need them anymore. It's sort of like saying, I'm going to throw aside my 55-year-old wife for my 25-year-old secretary. I mean, don't we need to recognize the role that unions have played historically? Look at the history of what the workplace was like before unions existed, and then extrapolate that may be where the workplace would be going in the absence of unions?
you know, the workplace is not a marriage. We are all free to pursue other opportunities, and there's no moral obligation to, you know, if you have a marriage that's not working out well, there's still still an obligation that you shouldn't walk away from it. At least that's kind of widely understood. A job is not like a marriage. If you're not happy with a job and you see a better opportunity, there is no and never really has been any moral obligation to remain with it.
Well, what I meant here, you know, is that, you know, it used to be people said, oh, because of unions, American workers are non-productive. And we now know that that's not true, that American workers are very productive in a global comparison. What I'm trying to say is that we have a system that has delivered for the American economy over time. It has addressed very serious problems in the workforce, and now it's being characterized as being a bad thing for America. And I'm not just saying through right-to-work states, but through the general drumbeat against unions across the country. And that's where I see sort of the problem. When we demonize unions, we really ignore the fact that they have brought us to where we are now in terms of workplace protection, pay and benefits. And what, you know, when I hear people who promote right to work, they say, oh, well, the employer would still give health care, or the employer would certainly pay a competitive wage. But that wasn't the case before there were unions.
Well, a free society is always evolving. And technologies and even institutions sometimes have served their purpose, and you know, they take a lead for a while, they serve their purpose, and then something better is found, and old institutions sometimes have to reinvent themselves or sort of take less of a prominent role. You know, it used to be the case that the rotary telephone, the analog telephone system, the old bell system,
right,
was a wonderful system, and it did us a lot of good, and it did a lot to unify a country, to help people stay in touch with their friends and relatives and loved ones across the country. And then over time, something new came along, and you know, we developed first cell phones, and then the internet, or maybe it was the internet, then the cell phones, whichever it was, and the old bell system had to sort of step into the background,
and that's
acceptable.
Right. Yeah, I understand that, but let's take a constant, one that's a historical issue as well as a current issue, mm-hmm, and that's workplace safety. Mm-hmm. And statistically, workforce injuries are much higher in right-to-work states than in the union states. I mean, that was a problem at the turn of the century, the 20th century. It has been a problem all along, and it is a much greater problem in right-to-work states.
I wouldn't characterize it that way. The workplace injury situation, yeah, I think you can find that there is some discrepancy, and workplace injuries are a bit higher in right-to-work states than in non-right-to-work states. But again, the difference is actually fairly modest. And again, going back to the example of Oklahoma, there's been no shift in workplace injuries, no dramatic shift or certainly not a huge positive shift in workplace injuries in Oklahoma since they passed a right-to-work law.
Right, but there have been any other right-to-work states.
I'm not familiar enough to say either way on what those numbers are. I'd have to go back and take a look at them. But again, I'm not aware of any research that shows that there's any significant increase in workplace injuries after a right-to-work law is passed.
Okay.
Because the union is, the unions are out there, they are accountable to workers, and obviously workers are going to be paying attention to workplace
right.
injuries.
But the worker who doesn't want to pay a carrying charge to the union gets the benefit of those safe machines and those safety procedures in the same way that the worker who pays his or her freight does.
Again, you're assuming that the union actually does provide a benefit in your particular workplace, which we can't assume from here. And you're also forgetting that you're talking about a pretty you know, a sizable but a definite minority of workers.
Okay, let's pivot here. I want to talk about the unionized public employees, because that's been a big issue here in Michigan. It's a big issue in Wisconsin, Ohio, and I know that the center has been very aggressive in calling for changes there, particularly for ratcheting back or eliminating union activities and bargaining power for public employees. What's that all about?
Well, I think you struck the nail on the head when you just used the word power. The question is, who is going to finally make the decisions on how public agencies are run and how tax rates are set and how budgets will be set by local governments?
Well, but wait a second. Who will decide and then local governments? Don't seem to go together in terms of recent legislative action in Lansing. As a matter of fact, there seems to be a very aggressive attempt to remove lots of these decisions from local government entities. We now have state rules about how much health insurance can cost, what local governments can agree to. We have rules about who can get health insurance benefits. We have rules about bidding out certain kinds of jobs and services. Those are not coming from local governments. Those are coming from the state of Michigan.
Well, there's a couple of things about the legislation that's been coming out of Lansing. First of all, most of it is about containing the costs that are associated with collective bargaining. What is called the 80-20 rule that sets limits on the benefits that employees can receive. There actually is a local opt-out, and numerous communities have actually taken advantage of that.
Opt-out how? They can pay more than the legislated amount for health insurance?
Yes, it requires a separate vote of the county commission or school board or city council, but there actually is an opt-out provision for this. The emergency financial manager rules, the emergency managers were there long before this particular governor or this particular legislature in place. And in fact, if you were to repeal the emergency manager changes, you wouldn't actually restore any meaningful power to local elected officials. All you'd be doing is reducing the options that an emergency manager has if one is put in place.
Mm-hmm. Now, Governor Snyder said he wouldn't push for right-to-work legislation, but he would certainly sign it. I mean, what's the distinction there?
Well, I think the question is whether the sort of the force of the office is going to be out there, whether he's going to be out there publicly pressing for this thing.
Or his lieutenant governor is going to be.
Or his lieutenant governor or anybody else in his administration is going to be actively pursuing this. The governor has a lot of ability to sort of set the agenda in Lansing, and Snyder has indicated that he's not opposed to it in principle, but it's not a high item on his agenda, and it's not something that he's going to be taking a lead on.
But if he said to the legislature, bring it on, I'll sign it, I mean, doesn't that encourage the legislature to move forward?
If he were to, it certainly would encourage the legislature to move forward, but I don't expect him to take that kind of role.
Okay. No, but he's already done it. He's already said, I will sign it if it comes to me. Right?
Yes, but again, let's put it this way. I guess there's a distinction between saying I'll sign it and if it comes to me, and please send it to me. I guess
okay.
That's the.
All right. I want to go over to something that was a controversy a couple of months ago, and that was when the center filed Freedom of Information Act requests for emails from employees of the professors within the labor policies departments in the three major universities, Michigan State, University of Michigan, and Wayne State University. And the argument was that they wanted to see if people in these public positions, these publicly paid positions, were engaging in politics in the sense of taking a position or communicating a position on what was relative to what was going on in Wisconsin. Can you speak to that?
Well, I think the concern, the basic concern, and I think all Michiganders should understand this and should appreciate this, is that there was that the academic professionals, the professors, the researchers at the state university were starting to act as partisans the competition between unions and management and workers.
So that's a partisan issue.
Yeah, maybe not partisan in the sense of Republicans versus Democrats, but partisans in the sense of unions versus management and in some cases even against workers, we would argue. Let me give you one example. When I was when this was going on, I actually went to a labor summit that Wayne State University's labor studies program put on,
mm-hmm.
and it was basically a labor rally. They had it was largely or almost entirely a union panel that they had there,
mm-hmm.
and the entire focus of the presentation was how do we expand unionization, how do unions pick up their power, increase
mm-hmm.
their power, and a lot of it was about partisan political stuff, legislation that was working through Congress and through the state legislature. At some point, if you're going to have a legitimate labor studies program, what really should be the focus is not just labor unions, but how do we make labor relations work all around?
Well, it also seems like if you're going to be concerned about political activity and taking sides in these kinds of issues, that you would also want to FOIA people in the business schools in each of the universities, or perhaps in the economic department, because we certainly see people in those positions taking positions, working with groups who have a particular perspective on these. Did the center do that?
That's a fair question to ask, and I guess my response would be to say that the indications that we had sort of going forward into this were that this was more of a problem at the labor relations studies.
Well, did you
programs.
Actually look into it in the business? I mean, do you have data that suggests business professors do this less often than labor studies professors?
I would say that yes, the information that we have indicates that this is a more of a problem with labor studies professors, and a lot of it, I will admit, is anecdotal. But again, there was the labor rally that I saw at Wayne State that was supposed to be an academic forum, and I'm not aware of anything that has come up like that at any of the business schools. If you've heard of something along those lines, we'd be happy to look into it for you.
Okay.
The other thing I would say is that business is much more bipartisan in terms of, you know, especially the larger businesses tend to be much more bipartisan. They will support, really, to be perfectly honest, they support whoever they think is going to win next.
Well, certainly not the advocacy groups. They tend to be quite partisan. But we're going to have to stop here today, or we're going to have to stop here, Paul. I appreciate that you were willing to talk to me today. I think you've given people a clear sense of sort of the arguments for right to work.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. That was Paul Kersey, who is the Labor Policy Director for the Michigan-based Mackinac Center.